you know, suffering genius, the person who has no social grace and they can't tolerate the boring mundanities of life because they're too busy sort of dreaming the future.
Yeah.
And they get frustrated with people easily and they're you know, they end up dying young and you know, killing themselves or whatever. And definitely music is full of those types. But there is also...
That applies for painters as well.
Oh, for sure.
That next to Beethoven.
Who would be like Van Gogh, maybe? Yeah, Van Gogh, most famous?
He suffered from depression. We have also Edvard Munch, Francisco Goya, Frida Kahlo, all these like suffering artists, big names that we know that, you know, they suffer in life. And because of their suffering, their work was more interesting to the viewer, I think.
Hi.
Oh my God, hi.
Oh my God.
It's been so long.
Oh, I see. do you need me to remind you who I am?
Oh, please, yes.
My name is Austin.
Hi, Austin.
I was explaining to a friend yesterday that my last name is Wintery, but that is not the word used to describe cold weather. That word is wintry.
Wintry.
There's no O in wintry. I've been told repeatedly, like, oh, so, you know, you must be freezing or whatever, even like as a little kid, you know. And summery versus wintry.
Uh-huh.
And occasionally, I'll get like tagged on stuff by mistake because somebody's trying to write wintry and they'll type wintry. And so I was telling a friend, he made some comment. And I was like, well, if you don't mind me being a annoying professor for a moment, it's two different words. And he was like, I love technical language, stupid shit like this. I was like, good, because I'm definitely my father's son in this way. I grew up with that kind of...
Oh, my God. That I know.
You know, like when people go, I could care less if we go out to dinner tonight or whatever. And it always bothered me, because of my father. They mean I couldn't care less. Like, there's no amount of caring below my lack of caring. And yet, somehow, it's the normal thing for people to say I could care less. It's very stupid.
Yeah, you're so technical. I know, I have to deal.
It's not technical. It literally makes no sense. It's
you always ambush me with, you know what? I will give you credit because I learned. But yeah, and I'm Laura Mudes. Thank you for coming back, episode 10. And we have a lovely surprise for you guys for being with us all this time. I think it's actually, it feels very new still, but...
Well, 10, I mean, each one's about an hour. So, yeah. You know, if somebody's listened to put that in context, if somebody has listened to all 10... The runtime is almost that of the entire extended edition Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Wow, that's amazing, yes.
Yeah, you know, like it's probably, because we're usually an hour and change, and so we add it up, it's probably 11 hours or so of content.
That's awesome.
A pretty healthy amount of time to listen to somebody, you know, considering how affected you are by the characters at the end of those movies. Shows that's enough time to feel invested, in other words. So yes, continue though.
No weather today. I think we're all very good. LA has been less hot, so there's no complaints.
Yes.
So yeah, let's get into topic.
I turned off my AC, I'll have you know.
Oh my God, that is exciting.
Well, because it's tolerable to do editing. So this time. So yes, no background noise for you to deal with.
Oh, that is lovely.
You're welcome to both you and listeners who had good quality headphones.
They don't suffer. They don't suffer. At the end, I deliver a very clean take. But yes,
sounds like they better not complain.
Yeah, they better.
No, what?
I think...
you were going to say a surprise. And
yes, we have our pretty lovely, unique, one-of-a-kind microphone. And I've been so excited to give this away. Last time, the person never wrote back. So it sounds a little bit sad, but it's only fair that we do this again. Because I, again, want to give this to somebody who actually listened to the podcast and not just, you know, not just because they saw the post and retweeted or whatever, they're going to get it. I do want to give it to somebody that is actually, that knows what we talk about here, that knows the meaning of those little icons that are all drawn around the microphone. And I think it's very, I mean, it's super symbolic. And
yeah, that's cool.
If anything, you guys, you know how it is. I have all the names here. There's, I think, like 200 people that participated.
And wow, that's more than I realized.
Yeah, it was all through Twitter. They retweeted and they quote retweeted. And yeah, I'm going to do that. Like, I was checking on different websites that actually let you check who retweeted and who followed. Brushes and Keys on Twitter, which is just awesome. You know, I don't have to check manually if the person follows or not. So that's cool. So anyway,
I will also add in that same vein that we are planning, as I saw you posted and solicited people's ideas, we are planning to do periodic special episodes where we bring on a guest. And it's also encouraged that people leave comments of who they are, you know, would love to see us kind of chat with. I think especially if it's someone we don't know or have much history with or something like that, that could be really interesting. And people undoubtedly will know folks that we don't know.
Yeah, and, exactly. We were discussing several options, and a lot of people, I remember checking on Twitter, they said people that we already know, that they said, well, I guess the majority was calling Troy. And I feel so hesitant because, I mean, I don't want to repeat the same story. You guys have your own thing on your YouTube channel and you have another podcast, and bringing Troy here is too redundant. So
I mean, look,
I'm so sorry, but
conversation with Troy is always fantastic, and I guarantee it wouldn't be overlap. But I share the idea that it would be nice to talk with folks that we've never
hung
out with or talked to or whatever. So either way, point being, folks, we welcome suggestions of conversationalists that we could bring in.
For sure.
With,
so. And you guys, just to remind you that you can write us an email or tweet directly to us. Links are in the description of every episode.
Beautiful.
So stereotypes.
Topic for the today, was specifically, I actually can't remember. I assume it was you, but I don't really remember who.
I think it was me.
Put this one on
the
document.
It was one of the first topics that I wrote on the list because it's so basic. I think it's something
well,
that we
specifically
start to
notice. It's not stereotypes in this abstract sense. It was specifically artist stereotypes.
Yes.
And I just found myself thinking about it because there's like there's two different categories of types of stereotypes that come to mind from my angle for composers. And because it's something I think about all the time, there's like category one is about their actual personality, the stereotypes of like, you know, the classic sort of number one, the most famous would be your Beethoven style, you know, suffering genius, the person who has no social grace and they can't tolerate the boring mundanities of life because they're too busy sort of dreaming the future.
Yeah.
And they get frustrated with people easily and they're, you know, they end up dying young and you know, killing themselves or whatever. And definitely music is full of of those types. But there is also...
That applies for painters as well.
Oh, for sure.
That next to Beethoven.
Who would... Yeah, who would be like Van Gogh, maybe, yeah, the Van sort Gogh, of most yeah, famous?
Like a... This, you know... He had suffered from depression. We have also Edvard Munch, Francisco Goya, Frida Kahlo, all these like suffering artists, big names that we know that, you know, they suffer in life. And because of their suffering, their work was more interesting to the viewer, I think. I don't know.
Well, so that's the question that I remember once getting into a conversation with that. With a friend of mine, Michael Gunn, actually, funny enough, this was 10 years ago.
Wow.
He was working for Aaron Sorkin on The Newsroom, and he said that he and Sorkin had been having a conversation about this exact thing, this exact idea of like the suffering artist, because Hollywood's full of that as well. There's a lot of directors and screenwriters that, you know, like we watched The Offer recently, where you see Coppola,
yep.
And he's kind of like an insane person, you know, they portray him as very rude almost and aggressive because he's such a perfectionist. It has to be right. And that's especially difficult of a personality to have when you're in a very collaborative medium and you need people to work with you and like you. And, you know, conductors fall into the same as well. There's a lot of conductors that are famously just, you know, absolute... monstrous assholes.
Can I name one stereotype of conductor?
What's that?
The penguin tail.
The your stereotype in the clothing choices, perhaps.
Yes. At first, when I started going to concerts, I wondered if they actually do that, because I started noticing that they don't. And then at some point, one of them did it. I don't remember which concert was this one, but I was like, oh, so that exists. So that is not just a cartoon thing. They actually have the tail. And what is the purpose of this? So anyway.
It's funny. I don't actually have any idea. I've never gone to research the origins of that tradition, but it definitely, I think, has fallen out of fashion. And most conductors now wear something quite minimal.
Yeah.
I used to conduct with my jacket, my suit jacket. And then at some point I realized it was actually really screwing up my conducting.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't have it's full a little range tight. Of motion.
Yes, yes. You need space on your shoulders to be able to move.
And it was affecting my posture and all that. And at one point, because I would look at videos of myself conducting and I would hate it. I would go, God, I look so amateur. And then at one point it clicked, like the jacket is actually, you know how like when you hurt your foot, so you walk weird to avoid putting pressure on it, and then your muscles start to get really sore because you're using them ever so slightly wrong than normal,
right.
and it stresses them out and it exhausts them. And I realized I was, even though it was microscopic, I was making a lot of little adjustments to accommodate the jacket and the fact that I couldn't lift my arms fully in any direction and that kind of thing. And it's not that the jacket's tight. It's just not designed
for full range of motion. You guys should conduct in cat suits. that way we have a better view as an audience.
My friend Chris Dragon went very viral years ago conducting Jurassic Park in one of those inflatable T-Rex. That video went all over the internet. I mean, millions and millions of views. That was during one of our Colorado Symphony Comic-Con
shows.
He
definitely had to rely on the orchestra to do their best.
Oh yeah, he could barely see.
Yeah.
In any case, he's awesome. He's always up for that kind of stuff. He did How to Train Your Dragon wearing a dragon costume once.
Was the actual dragon?
No, it's like from a Halloween store, you know, it was like a generic dragon costume. It was green. It wasn't like the black toothless one.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in the middle of the concert, we were passing each other because I was going to take over for him. And I grabbed my phone in front of the whole audience and took a selfie with him, like with the audience behind us.
Oh, amazing.
Because I said, it's the only time I'm ever going to take a selfie of a guy named Dragon, dressed like a dragon, after he just finished conducting How to Train Your Dragon.
That's amazing.
And so I have this blurry old cell phone.
Oh, I remember. It was like it's so bad.
It's like a bad selfie camera on a 12-year-old cell phone or whatever God. It was. It wasn't that quite that long ago. But in any case, yeah, so I think it was Stokowski who was famous for who would yell, "Bastardi tutti," to the orchestra. All of you are bastards, basically. There are conductors that are famously just absolute monsters on the podium where they think the only way to get them to really play like an ensemble, like one breathing body, is to have an iron will forced upon them.
You know what? Now that you mentioned that, I think that is a very European thing. I'm not saying
conducting in general came from Europe.
Yes,
so,
but yeah, absolutely. If you think about, I don't know, dancers, ballerinas, that's exactly the same environment.
Yeah, the classic, Russian ballet, in Paris, the Ballet Russe.
Yeah, the teacher, it's always, they portray them in movies or TV shows or whatever, they portray them as this Russian angry aunt.
It's okay, I know that you're thinking about The Simpsons.
God, I was not thinking about that one, but yes.
She says it takes more than fire or belly fire to be the next Borishnikov.
That's amazing. Yes, I love it. Oh, my God. I love that you are quoting The Simpsons so much. I have another quote. Another we're talking about the starving artist, the suffering artist. There's one of those that it's season one or season two, the very old one, where Homer... says to Moe, they're in the bar and they say, I wonder why stories of degradation and humiliation make you more popular. And Moe answers, I don't know, they just do. And that's the end of the episode. And that, ever since I saw that, that never left my mind. It's so true.
Yeah, I remember the line. I remember
the episode is the Homer, Dancing Homer.
Oh, right. Yeah, the mascot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that is old. That might very well be season one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting. And there's so many famous artists and composers who suffered their whole life and then only in death became sort of noteworthy to us, which is the ultimate suffering, that they never even saw the rewards of their work. Because you said the starving artist, and I would argue that's actually a totally different and not necessarily overlapping stereotype with suffering artist, mm-hmm. because you can have somebody who is wildly successful and obviously, you know, still suffering and still tortured, as it were.
That's true.
There's many instances of that. I, in a sense, Leonard Bernstein is sort of adjacent to that. He was not quite the suffering artist in the manner of someone like Beethoven, but he did give his all to what he worked on.
He was very passionate, and that often leads you to, you know, dramatic results.
Yeah, there's a story I remember reading in one of the biographies that I've read. I think every biography written about him, and I can't remember which one it was, but there was one where they said it was on, I think, his 56th birthday that he was found crying because he was the age Beethoven had, or maybe it was like 57th birthday, because now he was officially older than Beethoven ever got to. And he felt like, I'd not done what Beethoven did in his life. And that's the kind of thing, the sort of suffering, sort of like constantly feeling inferior to others. And but the funny thing is, he definitely was also the hard opposite of that, because he was so joyful and he loved, like, when you, especially when you watch footage of him conducting, you know, things like mm-hmm. his own music, like from West Side Story or Candide, he's always basically dancing. And you can see him, like, one of my favorite bits ever is watching him conduct the Mambo from West Side Story. And if you watch Michael Tilson Thomas, sort of, you know, most famously associated with conducting the San Francisco Symphony and one of the most famous proteges of Leonard Bernstein. He conducts it very similarly. It feels like it's almost like Lenny Reborn, where you get these moments that I just find it so fun and infectious.
I think it will be rare. Obviously, I don't know this, but it will be rare to see somebody conducting that piece specifically with like a poker face.
Well, but there's a difference. Yeah, of course. But most conductors do, you know, they're very, you know, like precise, and they're trying. It's an intense job. It's a challenging job. So you're trying to make sure that you're doing everything that you need to be doing. Sometimes you'll see, like John Williams, you'll see this, and certainly with Bernstein, plenty of examples where, you know, the trumpet needs to come in, they cue the trumpet, and the trumpet starts playing, and they're really happy with it, and they just give them a big smile. And it's one of those that it's probably largely involuntary, but there is also an element of like a leadership skill in that. It's not just me reacting, it's wanting the musician to know you're doing great. And since you don't want to shout out to him,
right,
you just smile and make eye contact and do that. But Bernstein would go beyond that. The thing that I always loved about watching him is the way he moves his shoulders. Yes. And I see Michael Tilson Thomas do the same thing, at least when conducting Bernstein's music, that you really feel that he's inviting the audience, I mean the orchestra, to go beyond playing the right notes, but to recognize that this is supposed to be fun. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be theatrical and joyful. Music is supposed to be a glorious, communal, shared, you know, kind of ecstatic experience. Mm-hmm. Even if it's somber and brutal music, there's something very beautiful about the shared activity of it, and that should be ultimately a joyous one. A lot of conductors, though, just simply did not have that attitude. Mm-hmm. didn't and still don't. It's considered in a way beneath them. They're supposed to be serious professionals.
Right.
And but in terms of stereotypes, I mean, that is the most common one, of course. But every now and again, there is that stereotype of the artist or the composer who is actually just happy all the time and really kind of in a good mood and optimistic. And yeah, maybe that could be one style. And
I have one question. You kind of like started this saying there are two groups.
Yeah, this is all category one.
Oh my God, okay.
I was going to mention Rossini as a composer who was famously supposedly always happy and supposedly cried twice in his life, which was once when his first opera failed. He was most famous for writing opera. You know, you would know him, of course, for the Barber of Seville with, you know, but he wrote many operas, and supposedly his first one was a sort of disaster, and he cried, but he was otherwise someone always in a good mood. And supposedly the second time he was said to have cried, I remember where I read this. I'll have to go back and double check it to make sure I'm not wrong, and I'm not misremembering some aspect of this. But he was on basically a cruise, like a boat, like a yacht, doing like a harbor cruise, and a wave shifted, and there was this beautifully truffled turkey that slid off the deck into the water. And supposedly that was the only other thing that ever made him cry.
That is so funny.
He was basically a very happy and, you know, successful and he was very famous in his time. And, you know, so he was one of those rare, like, he wasn't appreciated in death. He was famous.
Wow. I only can think of Willie. He once said, "I didn't even cry when my dad was hung. He died hung or something." I don't remember exactly what he says. Yeah,
something like that.
But I cry watching Ralph portraying, what was it, George Washington?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Lincoln. Wasn't it?
No,
was,
I think it was Washington.
No, it was Washington. It was you're
George.
Right. You're right. Do you have any friend artists that they're kind of unpleasant to be around because they're just so intense about it all? Do you have any?
I don't have any friends like that because I often avoid that kind of vibe. So I don't think I have any friends that like that you're describing. All of us suffer, yes. All of us struggle. But publicly, I don't, like, if you know them as this dark aura of complaints and struggle every single day. No, I don't have anyone in mind. But we do. I do quietly. Whatever happens to me when I feel that, yeah, things are shitty, I do it, but I don't like to show it publicly. So I just keep it for myself. I suffer
right
in silence. And I think most of us do that as well. I obviously, there's a lot of people that likes to complain as a common thing. But
that is different, though. I really do mean somebody that they can't, their work never gives them peace. Their work is like, they truly, like, I'm thinking of that, truly that Beethoven image of somebody.
No, I think, you know what? I think that applies for every artist. And one of the stereotypes is that we are perfectionists.
I would never say that it's every artist, though. I mean, there's plenty that go, good enough, and then
well,
move on, you know?
Well, every real artist is a perfectionist.
Oh, well, that's quite a statement to make.
I'm just saying.
I like
saying
that you knew what you were getting into before you even finished the sentence.
I'm just saying. I don't know.
So Rossini, by that measure, is Rossini not a real composer compared to Beethoven because he didn't seemingly suffer in this way?
No, please, come on. But he wasn't like, this will do.
But it could be. I mean, I remember I had a seminal experience once at NYU where there was a composer who was, actually, this was a story told to me. Sorry. There was a writer who'd written at least one book about the history of film music named Royal S. Brown, who came and spoke to our class of art composers at NYU. And he was talking about an instance where he had attended a master class taught by, I believe the composer was Leonard Rosenman, and is a very well-known composer from the earlier days of Hollywood. He kind of straddled the golden and silver age. He's long gone now, but in any case, Leonard Rosenman, they asked him something like, you know, where do you find inspiration when writing some of these really spectacular, like action scenes or like a chase scene or something very dramatic and very energetic, you know, like a car chase or a big battle or something like that? Where do you find inspiration? And he said some comment like, anything fast works. And it was one of those where it's like everyone was sort of taken aback that he was so nonchalant about it. And I think there's plenty of composers that feel that way. John Powell at the ASCAP Awards, he was given the Henry Mancini Award at the ASCAP Awards a few years ago. It's his Lifetime Achievement Award. He's quite young to receive an award like that, in my opinion, because he's still very much going at it, but he's already made such an incredibly huge impact on the industry that it was very well deserved, certainly. And he did something that he's very classy for a lot of reasons. He did two things that night that were very unforgettable. The first thing he did was, when you win that award, it's not even winning, they just choose you. They just say, this year we're going to honor this person, and you don't like apply for it, they just decide based on one's career. And so normally the person, they show a video of a bunch of like the directors that this person's worked with over the years or whomever, give speeches about them, tell them how awesome they are. We get like a little documentary about their career and what they've done and blah, blah, blah. Then the person is invited to come up and give a speech of thanks and then perform some of their music with like a small kind of mini orchestra. And John Powell did something that no one's done before or since, which was he felt weird performing his own music. He's kind of shy. He's very charismatic and funny and charming, but he's also kind of not like a big showman. So he goes, rather than play my music, the award is called the Henry Mancini Award, named after one of the great legends. And so he goes, I'm going to play for you some of my favorite music of Henry Mancini that you maybe don't know. And that's what he decided to do with his platform that night, which was so classy. It was so cool. And of course, that Henry Mancini, all this like smooth jazz, and it was just awesome.
That's awesome.
And so that was cool thing number two. The second thing that he did is he went through and he named and thanked every assistant he's ever worked for him as part of his speech. And that's something that's like an interesting topic in the world of Hollywood, because there's a lot of assistants that go uncredited or who do a lot of work that is not reflected in how they're credited. You know, they'll be essentially credited as if they're the coffee person, and they maybe actually wrote some of the music. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, wow.
So there's a little bit of a, we're at a little, that's increasingly being publicly spoken about, mm-hmm. and made more and more taboo.
Mm-hmm.
But for a long time, it was a bit of a darker side to the industry. I certainly am always against not crediting people for the work that they do.
Mm-hmm.
But he made a funny comment that night where he goes, you know, I want to thanks to all the assistants who helped keep me on schedule and who helped, you know, prepare sheet music and la-da-la-da-la-da-la-da. And then at the end he goes, and also, you know, occasionally would write some cues that I really just didn't feel like writing.
Oh, my God.
He said it in such a funny way, and it was clear what he meant. Like, every now and again, you'll have a movie where there's like a 5-second scene where you need a cue that goes boodaloodaboodala,
right?
And like, is a little transition, or they're not like the main moments, right. In other words.
Mm-hmm.
And those are perfect cues for an assistant to write, because it teaches them, they learn,
mm-hmm.
you're overseeing the process as their boss, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's, there's a lot of merit to actually assigning a cue like that rather than doing it yourself. Anyway, all of which to say, again, this is somebody who seemingly really suffers for their art, if only because he just does such incredible work. But he was very nonchalant about, like, you know, sometimes it's okay to just,
yeah,
you know, have this person do it. I say all this because this is my rebuttal to you going, well, you know, it can't be a real artist if you're not like hyper protective perfectionist. And there are examples of some folks who just like, you know, something works out. Another good example, Mark Snow writing the theme to The X-Files. It starts off with this very famous arpeggio where you hear the thing go, you know, you remember the theme to The X-Files before the whistling comes in with the...
Yep.
And
I always used to cover my face when that whistle starts.
It's very creepy. So the story was that David E. Kelly, the creator of The X-Files, came over to Mark Snow's studio, and because this is the late 90s and it wasn't like today where a computer can do everything in the software, he had all of his gear everywhere, and supposedly the story was that he bumped it, the director, the showrunner, he bumped it and turned on the arpeggiator setting and made it, instead of going like bump, it went ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba.
Amazing.
By mistake.
Yeah.
And it was like, ooh, that's great. Go with that. You know? So it's like moments, there's so many stories like this.
But he thinks that's perfect. And it works. It's not some half-made thing. It's not some like trash.
Okay, this is fair enough. This is, okay. So I guess this is where we're potentially crossing our wires slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And we're conflating perfectionism with the idea of the suffering artist. Because you can, my point is, these were situations where compelling art was made that there was no suffering on account of,
yeah,
or at least
we kind of like cross the topic, because here I'm just gonna clarify, here I have 15 stereotypes, 15 artist stereotypes, and my first one was that we are perfectionists.
Oh, you have like a real list in front of you.
I do.
Well, all right. Well, here, let's go through your list, and then I'll just quickly say what my second category was.
Okay. I was actually eager to hear the second, but
I'll say what it is real quick because it's simple. This is just, I mean, there's probably a lot of categories. I mean, you have a list of 15, but the idea of like I broke it into two types, where category one is the different emotional stereotypes of like the absent-minded crazy person or the suffering tortured soul.
Uh-huh.
I've met composers, and you certainly read about composers of all these different kind of stereotypes, personalities, and I think it's interesting. I very easily personally slip into the sort of suffering artist, very too easily perhaps, and I really do kill myself over even the most trivial things sometimes, but in a way that I don't think is something to be proud of. But the second category is not so much personality types. It would reflect, it's connected to it, but it's sort of like the stereotypes around work ethic, or even you could even describe it as the career type, because I always think of the dichotomy between like Beethoven and Bach, where, or Brahms and Bach, where Beethoven and Brahms both were the kind of composer where they would agonize over a piece until it was right. And in the case of Brahms, you know, sometimes he would spend many years trying to perfect it and get it better and tighter and closer and improving it and like really, and this is that perfectionist thing. Bach was like this working church musician who had to have new music every Sunday. So it was like, write it, get it done, mm-hmm. perform it, move on.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote mountains of music as a result. And I remember where this stems from is I remember there's like the parable of you know, I don't even know if this is a true story, but it was presented to me as if it was a true story where there was like an art teacher that said like for like a making clay, you know, like whatever you would call that, like sculpting, I guess. But the idea was they were going to make clay pots.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And it was an art class, like a college art class. And they said, your whole grade is going to come down to essentially the quality of a single pot that you make. And so half the class will have the entire semester to perfect one piece, just meticulously make it amazing. The other half of the class will make as many as they can and choose the best one from the many. And the takeaway was that, like, by far the best pots were in the second group because they were improving and constantly working this muscle and you know, refining their technique because they would quickly move on and try again.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of composers that kind of fall in one or two of those mm-hmm. camps, you know, like John Williams is much more like Beethoven and Brahms. He's really not written that many film scores compared mm-hmm. to a lot of others. He's very picky. He does exactly the movies he wants and he puts all of his energy and focus into it. And then that's it. Jerry Goldsmith was the opposite. He was like Bach. He wanted to never, ever be unemployed no matter what. So his agent, Richard Kraft, once said that Jerry was like this blue collar genius because he really mainly just wanted to have a job.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just that he was this genius artist, but he just liked working. He wanted to always be working on something. And so it didn't matter if it was a good movie or a high budget movie or whatever, prestigious or lame, silly, whatever. He would give it everything he's got and then move on. Alexandre Desplat is the same way. He once said he doesn't like working on a movie for more than like 4 or 5 weeks. And he puts everything into it, focuses, turns it out, boom, move on, next one. And you look at Desplat, he's written like 1,000 scores in the last 10 years.
I see. I thought he was more picky with the jobs.
He's picky. He's just so in demand that he has a million things to choose.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at his IMDb, it's like, good Lord. I mean, mm-hmm. the guy routinely will do like half a dozen or more movies per year.
Wow.
I mean, major feature films, you know, with elaborate recording sessions. And occasionally some of those are monstrous films like Harry Potter or
right.
whatever, where you realize like, this is a huge undertaking. But he just wants to get in there. And
where
and,
do you
and
fall just, into this?
I'm a lot closer to the Goldsmith side of it, where I am a perfectionist for sure, but I also recognize that I'll go insane if I try to make this one piece of music the greatest thing I ever wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I try to make it everything that it can be and take the lessons that I learned and apply them to the next piece.
Right.
So the goal is to always be moving forward and
That's
always be trying
new things. Because
you have
a deadline to meet.
I don't think so, though, because even with personal side projects, like take Light in the Void.
Mm-hmm.
There are things about Light in the Void. For those who don't know what Light in the Void is, you can look it up. LITVconcert.com, I believe, is still active. Light in the Void was a concert created by me and a guy named Tony Lund, where we put together scientists giving speeches about their work in a TED Talk type format alongside theater style acting, but between two actors playing different characters. Troy was one of them, Hannah Hayes was the other. And the full symphony orchestra, in this case, the Colorado Symphony, creating like this long piece about science and art and the search for truth and sort of a narrative piece, but also a nonfiction science piece, and it was unique and weird, and it mostly works. You know, it was one of those where I kind of feel like it was my version of Bernstein's Mass, where people go, "I like it. It's not perfect," mm-hmm. And we worked really hard on it, and like. We got a lot of interest from other conductors and orchestras and things, and we could like continuously tweak it and revise it and do it again and then revise it some more and revise it. But I find myself going, it's going to take so much work. I kind of would rather make something new, even if it's something out of the ashes, mm-hmm. where it's a similar concept. I my instinct is to say, lessons learned. Now what could we make to build on that, you know?
Like Batgirl.
Yeah, thank God we didn't spend that much money, but yeah, it is a situation where that one, that it's not like there's a deadline in the manner that we're talking about, you know. But in any case, so I'm more in that. But what about you? I think I know your answer, but I want to know your side you fall on.
Where? Tell me, what is your answer?
Oh, I think you're similar to me. I think you would rather make a new painting than endlessly tweak the current painting.
That is true.
But I've seen that happen, which is why I
I'm currently doing that. I just toss an old painting in order to start again because it's not gonna go anywhere if I keep tweaking. There's a moment that you realize this is not gonna work.
I was scoring a pretty bad movie and I was killing myself to make it sound awesome. And it was just so obviously a bad movie. And I showed it to a friend of mine and he goes, "This music is so good. Don't you worry. It's like too good for the movie. Don't you worry that you'll, when a good movie comes along, you'll have used all your ideas wow. on the bad movie. And like now you're stuck with lesser ideas for a better movie." And like on the face of it, that might be a real worry, but it also operates under this belief that I'm going to run out of ideas. And I don't think I could pursue this career if I thought someday I'm just going to run out. I very well might, but I have to roll the dice that I'll always have something. And right. I mean, look at, you know, John Williams is still writing scores
there
at age 90.
There are so many composers that just copy themselves, even if they don't realize they do. So I think there's a point in which you have used your full potential. I don't know. I don't want to be this.
It varies person by person, though, because yes. Jerry Goldsmith wrote amazing music through into his mid-70s, shortly before he died. And, you know, there are other composers, you know, like Verdi. Well into the very end of his life, he was writing innovative, groundbreaking, you know, no fucks given type work as an old man, you know, so there definitely are those that never, you know, Brahms once said no composer ever wrote anything worthwhile above the age of 60, which he himself disproved, but he seemed to believe you do kind of run out of steam. But that's, you know, that's just simply, there's many examples of that not being the case.
Yeah, it doesn't apply.
But so you're in agreement then. You're in the, I prefer to.
Yeah, start over.
Yeah. All right. Well, what are your other stereotypes?
Oh, yes. No, it's a very simple list that I collected. But yeah, it is true that being an artist, for all of us, I think I'm very sure that we are all perfectionists and we want to give all we can, all we have to each piece, even though if they don't work as we expect to, we, of course, we suffer. So I don't know where I'm going here. But yeah, that's number one. Number two is that we live in a dream world.
That's the aloof sort of spacey, you know, person who seems very disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one of my teachers, Denise Hughes, she went to Yale and there was a composer named Jacob Druckmann who was one of her teachers. Druckmann is... history will probably regard him as a second-rate classical composer. I found his music to be quite powerful and interesting, and it really affected me a lot as a student. His piece Prism, I thought, was absolutely brilliant. And he was apparently, though, a terrible teacher because he was so, like, living in this dream space. And supposedly he once was, he would have these composition students and they would show his music and he would not really know what to tell them. He was just kind of in his own world and he was not very effective teacher, supposedly, is what they said about him. And one time, Denise said she was in a class, or maybe it was a student, a fellow, like a friend of hers, who was in a private lesson with him. And he was looking at their sheet music and he goes, "Oh," and like as if he's got this thought, he suddenly perked up and went, "Ooh." And they thought, "Oh my God, here it is. He's finally going to say something useful." And it was like, "Remind me, I need to call my doctor," or something like that.
Oh my so God.
It was some like reminder to himself that had occurred to him in that moment. And they were like, "Oh my God, so useless." But it's because you listen to his music and it's just like he's off in this dream world. So yeah, I can be guilty of that too. I have found myself iterating on pieces of music while in the midst of like in my head, while in the midst of intense conversations with people. Like someone will be confiding something very personal and I'll be paying attention, but I'll also realize I'm sitting there going, if the melody goes up to E flat instead of F,
that might be interesting. Oh my God, that is so annoying.
Like it's uncontrollable. All right, next.
We're moody and emotional.
I mean, yeah.
I think that applies.
That overlaps with a lot of other stereotypes.
You don't have to be an artist, but I guess that's redundant to the suffering.
Well, but it can also mean wild ups and downs. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be all about suffering.
That's true.
You can be over the top ecstatic and happy and then flip on a dime.
True.
Yeah, I've certainly met plenty of... I remember once... I think it was Jerry Goldsmith's wife made a comment publicly about how when Jerry is deep into a movie, he starts to kind of like absorb the personality of the characters. And if it's like a drama that's heavy about characters that are sort of difficult people, he kind of starts to become a difficult person.
Wow.
I always thought that was interesting. It always kind of made me wonder if that was a positive spin on a way of basically just saying when he's distracted with work, he's an asshole. And you're like trying to put a good take on why.
Yeah.
I don't know. Jerry was not the most lovable guy, according to everybody that knew him. He was a bit of a cantankerous old man. But
I keep saying if they're old, they have the right to be an asshole as much as they want. Like, we just have to respect.
I so disagree.
We have to respect that. They've lived for so long and they can complain and let them be. It's their moment to just.
Yeah, but still, how much nicer are the bright-eyed, optimistic, happy old people? We like them so much more.
That's true. But no, people
that are
respect,
so amazed.
Yeah, old people, yeah, whatever. If they want to be cranky old man, let them be.
Like, remember, there's this wonderful, sweet old man who lives near us that we see who goes for walks. And he always wants to say hi to Canvas. And, you know.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, of course.
He's our neighbor.
Yeah.
And he.
I haven't seen him in a while, but yes.
Yeah, I remember one night when we saw him out, we were taking her out late and we saw him walking and it was a little bit nervous because it was like, this man, he's very old.
Yes.
And we thought, it's pretty late to be out.
He suffers from
maybe a little bit of Alzheimer's.
The Alzheimer's, yes, because he has asked me if I live in the same building several times, and you know, so.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, but he always seems to remember. Maybe he just really loves dogs, and whether he remembers her or not, he always is very excited to see Canvas.
Yes,
but
that's true.
I remember that night we saw him. You know, he just said, "Remember," you know, he said something like, "You know, when you're old like me, you learn some things, and just remember, always have fun."
Oh,
I just remember he said that to us on the street.
Yes.
And it's like, here's a guy who's, you know, if I don't know how old he is, he might be 70, he might be 90.
Yes.
He seems quite old, but some people just age faster than others, so it's hard to tell, but he seems pretty old and he's really lived I want to believe a full life. I really don't know. We should ask him. But that's what I mean. Like, Yes, if someone's bitter and jaded as an old person, fair enough. But mm-hmm. I like the ones that can go through their whole life and reach the end, and they're actually happy. They're not, life hasn't broken them.
Yes, I know. I guess I just like old people, period. It doesn't matter if they're bitter. I just, you know, I respect them.
I know, you have a soft spot.
But yeah, well, moody and emotional. Next. Yeah, that was it. The next one is only hang out with fellow creatives, which is untrue. But I do like to, I search for it. I always like to be surrounded by creative people. I want to believe that I am building a lifestyle among other artists, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, there are many famous instances. The composers, the French composers, the Six, famously, you know, 100 and change years ago, who would all hang out with each other and play each other's music for one another. And, you know, Satie, I believe, was in that group, and Ravel. And you know, that was a thing. So composers gravitating to fellow composers is something historically known. I personally would agree. I accept that I have that stereotype, but it's non-composer creatives that I tend to seek out. Writers, directors, right. Cinematographers, photographers, obviously painter. You know, my history with Sonia. I like being around creative people that are using their creative efforts towards a different end than me. I have many composer friends who I greatly admire and who I love. I love seeing how they work. I love learning about their process. Why I do the Game Maker Notebook podcast. It's really fun to understand but fellow composers.
I think you have a just natural lifestyle in which you get to meet all these people because you have to.
I don't have to do that podcast, and I do it purely for fun.
Sure. But, you know, in a regular daily life, you get to just talk to people that is involved in the industry because...
Well, and that's where I actually would argue it's the other way around. I would say I've been able to find my footing in the industry because I like hanging out with people like that. Mm. Like composers that only like hanging out with fellow composers are always at a disadvantage compared to composers that like hanging out with filmmakers or game developers.
Right.
Because they're naturally not going to socialize with the people that give them work. Mm-hmm. In my case, so many of the career opportunities that I've had they were already friends. We were already bonding. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, hey, there's a cool thing if you want to work together, you know, like, but it wasn't, we became friends because we worked together. I mean, that does happen also, but mostly we worked together because we were friends and the career went from there. And that tends to be how a lot of careers were formed. You know, I mean, I remember reading about how Ryan Coogler and Ludwig Göransson first bonded. They met in like student dorms at USC or something like that at a party. And Ryan knew like Swedish bands that Ludwig, who was from Sweden, didn't think anyone outside of Sweden would have ever heard of. Or I think I'm remembering the story correctly. It was something along those lines where they just bonded. And then it was like, hey, you know, I'm working on some student films. You want to score them? And then that one thing leads to another, eventually becoming a essentially historic collaborative partnership.
You have to obviously explain what did it
do. Oh, well, Black Creed and Black Panther are their most famous films, of course. And now Black Panther 2, Wakanda Forever, is their next film together. Before Creed, they did Fruitvale Station, which was a high profile indie film. So, supposedly it all just started as like just basically realizing they really got along they became buddies, and you know, and so that said, I do think that it is true. I like meeting all types of people personally. I'll talk to janitors and, you know, waiters and Uber drivers and like people that theoretically have so-called non-creative jobs, because my belief is that actually every job has an opportunity to be creative, and there's nothing that people can do.
I will say you can find any person can be interesting. Not 100%. Necessarily creative.
Well, some people are better at being creative than others, but there's nobody that sort of like can't be if they, if they, you know, like they, and there's no job which doesn't benefit from being creative, I would argue. I know it's very idealistic to say that, but like, you know, a creative janitor is probably going to be a better one than a non-creative janitor. Like, I just think that there's no activity on this planet that I can think of that doesn't benefit from, because think about every industry that's ever had innovation in its technology or in its techniques. It's because somebody was doing that job and went, you know, I bet there's a way to do this better.
Right.
That's an inherently creative act.
Right.
And I think it's amazing. It's why I love shows like Shark Tank, where these are people that are trying to build businesses off of their creative insights, you know, whatever it is, or where they see opportunities. It's so anyway, yeah, I do think that people that are not using that muscle can be very boring, and I don't usually have long relationships with them. But if you are a creative person, even in a so-called non-creative industry, you will have my attention easily.
Nice. The next one is every artist have keen eyes for beauty.
Huh. I don't think I agree with that.
Yep. just a reminder, it's just only stereotypes. Of course, they're not like the ultimate truth.
The only way that one works is if we all agree on what beauty is, which I don't think there's any possible way for us all to agree on what's beautiful.
True.
True. But that's interesting. All right, keep going.
All artists are endlessly curious.
That's probably more true than not, although I do occasionally meet artists. I think it was the pet peeve I said
yes.
in the very first one of like meeting
you can't creative like people make it who are the, not. You make it like as a statement. You actually said, are you actually an artist if you're not curious? Like you were very.
I stand by that. Like it to me it's difficult to define what art is, but on some level I think art is the exploration of the new, and I don't understand. It's not exclusively that, because someone can make a beautiful painting of a coffee cup.
Yeah.
But I think on some level, seeing what's over the next hill is sort of baked into what an artist does.
Yeah.
And that requires curiosity.
Right.
As Neil deGrasse Tyson once said, without the curious artist types, we would have never left the caves, is how he put it. You know, without somebody wondering what's out there, we wouldn't have left. Someone had to be the one to do it.
Right. Number eight is all artists have very strong opinions about the quality of art.
I mean, that's probably true.
Yeah.
That's probably. I think every professional has strong opinions about their profession. It doesn't even have to be about art.
That's true. Yeah. Here, number nine. All artists are always broke unless they sell out.
Yeah, lame pass.
Whoa, okay. You have no comments on that.
I mean, that's bullshit. Jerry Goldsmith was wealthy. John Williams is incredibly wealthy. Hans Zimmer is wealthy. These are all great artists.
All right.
And it was true in classical music, too. There were many. George Gershwin famously approached Stravinsky to get orchestration lessons, and because he felt like Stravinsky was many times the artist that he could be. And Stravinsky asked Gershwin, how much money do you make? And he said something like, you know, $100,000 a year. And that was vastly more than Stravinsky was making. So he said, maybe I should be taking lessons from you. You know, like, you can definitely be a great artist and not be a sellout. That's one of those.
Right.
I'm convinced that bitter, unsuccessful artists who are jealous of others are the ones who created that mythology.
Mm. Fair enough. Number 10 is have high standards. And I think that is true.
I mean, isn't that the same as the perfectionist one at the beginning of the list?
I will argue, but I don't want to make this too long. But
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
11 are self-righteous and uncomfortable. What do you
I mean?
Feel?
Yes.
Do you feel?
Yes. No. I think that self-righteous artists who end up living in partly because they surround themselves with fellow artists. A lot of artists, and this is true of every discipline across every political stripe, they end up living in ideological bubbles, and they don't really have contact with folks outside their environment, and so then they just operate from this elitist position of I know I'm right because I'm a genius artist and all my friends are geniuses, and therefore we must know everything about the world. And so the self-righteousness, this is why a lot of people get so, this is why like normal middle class fundamentally kind of regular people, I say that with zero derision, this is why they get annoyed when Hollywood celebrities go, you know, make political speeches in their Oscar acceptance moment, because it's like, just because you've won an Oscar and you're famous doesn't mean you actually know more about these subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's hard for people to understand when they're surrounded by famous people who are the top experts in all these fields. They assume they must be exposed to the most current and accurate information, and they ignore the idea that they might be in a bubble. And this cuts across every political stripe. You know, just because Hollywood is left-leaning doesn't make this a problem amongst the left. It's a human problem.
Right. The whole thing was self-righteous and uncompromising and pretentious.
I mean, not, of course, not every artist is, but there are many that mm-hmm. uphold that for sure.
Number 12, have decadent lifestyles.
That's usually only if they can afford it.
That's it?
I mean, yeah, because, unless, like, so in other words, that one in a way contradicts the, they're all broke, because it's pretty hard to have a decadent lifestyle if you're broke. So I think that there are definitely some artists that are. I remember once a composer friend of mine, who shall remain nameless, was an assistant to another composer who was very famous and shall remain nameless. And my friend had no money. He needed this job very much. And one time his job that day was to sign for the delivery of a chair that cost like $15,000. And I remember he just found himself thinking, good God, this is more money than I'll make the whole year.
Wow.
And it's a chair that no one's even going to use. It's like a prop in the room that no one ever goes in. You know, like, and so, like, yes, sometimes that would be considered, I think, a decadent lifestyle. You know, I'm never one to judge people for spending the money they earned however they want. I don't care how people use their money. You know, good on them for doing so well, but it is definitely the cliche of a decadent lifestyle.
Yeah, for sure. That's crazy. Next one is art eccentric.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, wasn't the second one that they're like absent-minded?
Dream world.
Yeah, that's pretty similar.
Maybe eccentric. I don't know. I wouldn't put Van Gogh living in a dream world and being eccentric. He is eccentric, but I wouldn't say he lived in a dream world.
Well, I just mean that they often go hand in hand. They don't necessarily have to, but some people are, you know, they're very weird. Like Scriabin, there's an example of a composer who was very eccentric. He would write things like, the only way to perform this piece correctly is to hang bells from the clouds. Like he would write these instructions that everybody, or, you know, it was like, how am I supposed to do this? I think it was Stockhausen that wrote a piece that had to be performed in helicopters. There are composers that, you know, especially in the pursuit of the so-called avant-garde, end up getting a little bit wacky, and sometimes in absolutely wonderful ways, but sometimes in less pleasant ways.
The next one is always carry a sketchbook.
I think the modern equivalent to that is that I constantly leave messages for myself in my phone.
Audio messages?
Mm-hmm.
Like just saying, ooh, this idea.
Yeah, sometimes I go over to the piano and I set it up and I talk to myself and I talk through the piano, or sometimes I take walks and I leave myself long messages.
This is actually, Amber, I'm curious. Do you toodoo-doo or do you name the notes?
Yeah, that's, it's both.
Interesting. I would like to hear one of those.
I will never, ever, ever share any of them. I've often said, many times I have said, that I would love to develop an app that keeps on my phone, and if it ever, it's like connected to my heart, and if it registers that I've died, it deletes everything instantly.
What if you just skip a bit, or, you know?
Well, yeah, obviously I'd have to be clinically dead. I would need to like register no heartbeat for like an hour.
Maybe you came back to life and then you have to start over.
I don't think so. Well, yeah, at that point I'll be just happy to be alive, I guess.
Last one, eccentric clothes.
This one, I think, is not necessarily, you know, like a lot of composers I know go down the Steve Jobs route. I dare say myself.
You are very simple. Yes, you are.
I like to have my T-shirt, my jeans, my shoes, every day the same, basically. I don't like to think about it, but I do admire. Someday I may change on this because I look at friends like Alex Mukalla or Ludwig Göransson or Dan Pemberton, who treat their outfits as part of their artistic expression in the world.
That's true. A lot of artists.
And they are, they're memorable. It makes you can't forget interacting with them because their clothes make as much a statement as their music does.
Absolutely.
But I would say the majority of composers are not like that. The majority of composers put pretty much all their energy into
They prefer,
music.
I guess I'm kind of like in the middle because I do like to express my art through my art. Like, I just want my art to speak for me. Like, I don't need to wear a flashy, colorful T-shirt or dress to say, hey, I'm an artist. But I do like the fashion just because I naturally just like it. Maybe, I don't know. I do have French beret. I like that. But it's not that I don't wear
it. No, but there have been plenty of times where you and I were going out, even just to like a movie or to a simple dinner. And you made an effort to, it wasn't just look nice, but you looked creative, for lack of a better way to put it.
Creative? How do you
look like creative? Because your outfit was not intuitive. It was not something that you just grabbed. You built it. You didn't just pull it out of the top first thing on the shelf the way I do. You actually had put thought into what you were wearing, and it didn't feel like it was purely to look nice. It was conceived of
right
in some sense artfully.
Yeah, well, I guess anybody
even
that
if it's simple
goes on a date, they just want to look nice. But I'm talking here about artists that wear.
I'm saying it's beyond that though. That's my point. I'm saying it's not just to look nice. I think that you have made it an occasion to creatively dress yourself as an extension of your natural creativity. That's how it looks to me, even if it's simple.
I didn't know that. I just basically, for those, I just like to dress nice. But I guess after...
I would argue that's just how you define nice then.
Right. I was talking about wearing, the common, the jean onesie. How do you call that? The
overalls.
That kind of that type of the messy and then always carrying with a tripod, with a easel, brushes on your behind your ear, stuff like that. So that is very.
Sonia had a bathrobe that was like her painting, her version of the overalls.
The equivalent of the apron.
Yeah, it was like that was, she would often just wear that around and that was just her look. And she looked very much like an artist as a result because she was walking around in this paint-stained robe.
Right.
It was very funny.
Yeah, well, so that's the list. That's what I gather from here and there.
There you go.
Yeah.
Stereotypes are fascinating. That's why I thought it'd be fun to talk about because, on the one hand, they're always condemned as you shouldn't pre-assume things about people based on what little you know. Stereotypes are often not true, but it is also its own stereotype to then acknowledge that they become stereotypes for a reason. They become cliches for a reason because they actually are frequently true.
That's true.
I mean, every single one of those 15, I think just about, I was able to think of some example from the real world of someone. So like, they're definitely not bullshit, generally speaking.
Yeah, they're not.
You know, one that wasn't on that list that I can leave with is I think there's often a stereotype that artists are kind of inherently lazy because there's also the hardcore sort of workaholic perfectionist, but there are also the like they just want to lay around all day dreaming.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
You know, eating fruit by a riverside and never actually really doing anything productive as they look for inspiration. That's definitely a stereotype.
You're just describing Dionysio.
Dionysus,
yes, I didn't know how to say it.
It's true, actually, you're right. Like, the classic dichotomy was always between Apollo and Dionysus, where you have the, like, sort of industrious and also the very methodical and precise versus the inflamed with passion And artists have always been both. But in any case.
Here, I have all these people.
Oh, yes, our name.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So our microphone giveaway, our beautifully branded brushes and keys etched microphone, courtesy of Earthworks Audio. We started this podcast without seeking any kind of sponsorships or partnerships or anything. This was just to have fun and talk about stuff that we already talked together. And to their credit, they reached out and offered this partnership, and we gratefully accepted because their mics are cool. And just this customization is awesome, and you did a great job designing it.
Yeah,
so, yes, amazing. Pull the next name,
yes.
Or the replacement
name. So
here, name.
Almost 200 people participated on Twitter, and so I'm just going to pull up a winner right now. And the winner is...
The Gear Rules.
The Gear Rules. So, okay. The Gear Rules.
The Gear Rules. It kind of looks like it's the gorillas
at first glance. Spell it for me.
The G-I-R-R-U-L-E-Z.
Perfect.
The Gear Rules.
The Gear Rules. Okay, I hope that you can send us a message, because I'm not going to reach out to you to be sure that you actually listen to our podcast. And you have two
so
weeks.
Strict.
I am so strict. Yes, it's an awesome microphone.
It's true.
I wanted to give it to somebody that actually pays attention and is worth having it. So there you go.
I agree.
Yeah.
I love it.
Awesome.
All right,
Austin,
beautiful.
Thank you so much for this. Thank you guys for listening. You know that you can always talk to us through Twitter or even sending an email. Links are on.
See you next time. Bye.
Ciao. Yeah.